Good morning, everyone. My topic this morning will be the Sangamon Paleosol in the Southern Mississippi Valley. The objectives of this presentation will be to describe the Sangamon in the valley, particularly in four aspects: its geomorphic setting, the pedologic characteristics, the erosion history, the sedimentation processes that have gone on, and then lastly, how this might impact the climatic inferences one would draw from paleosol development. And let me preface this at this point. If we look at the geologic history and our understanding of paleosols in the geologic record, the Sangamon represents the most dominant and the most well-understood paleosol. So if we're going to draw inferences, this is the one we know most about. So if we're going to transform and carry paleosol development back into the geologic record, what we do with the Sangamon has impact upon the whole geologic record. The area that I'm going to focus on is the Southern Mississippi Valley, and in particular I'm going to look at four sites along the East Bluff, north to south along the Mississippi. All these sites are from about 0 to 5 kilometers off the present bluff. They have a thick package of loess that most of the soils or the paleosols are formed in. Four sites we'll deal with are the Yaconee River, the Williams Creek, the Sitaria, and Jeff Davis. I'm going to have data from three of these sites. The fourth site, Williams Creek, is a special site to me because it's a field site, and that's where I'm going to start here. Okay, the purpose of these next two or three slides is to give you an idea what the loess record and the paleosol sequence looks like, and also to focus on some of the important stratigraphic relationships that exist here and are useful and important to understand and interpret the record. I'm going to do a quick labeling. I mean, that is what we saw in the field. I mean, it was all labeled for us, so it was quite easy to figure this one out. Okay, what we have here is a sequence of the Wisconsin loess, the Peoria loess, which caps a paleosol, which is in this case the Sangamon. That overlies a Miocene age deposit called the Citronelle gravel. But what's unique about this site is the geologic record and the stratigraphic sequence here. What we can see is that there's a gully fill that's cut in to the Citronelle gravel. So you have a fluvial gravel that contains a gully fill. It has a silty paleosol in it that is buried by another loess deposit, and then a paleosol developed in that, and then the loess, the Wisconsin loess. So you have a sequence in here of three erosion cycles represented. So at the base of the Sangamon, it was coming in on a previous erosion cycle, which is not represented, at least in part, here on the gravel. The point being that if you're observing, and not all exposures are of this scale. The point being, if you're observing the Sangamon in this location, you're missing a piece of the puzzle. So you have to interpret these things based on a broader stratigraphic context, not just one profile or one sequence. It's what's going on a landscape basis. Another site, and if we trace this landscape laterally, we come to a gully fill, and this is what we find, or what we found in this gully fill. Okay, put the labels on this one. This one's a little more complex. Down here at the base, we have the Citronelle gravel. You can see the imbricated gravels here. If you trace these laterally, these get cut out and they get replaced by a matrix-supported gravel that grades, again, into an imbricated gravel. And in intervening, here is the Sangamon paleosol. So you have a gravel unit capped by a colluvial to alluvial gravel that blankets the Sangamon in this case, and then that in turn is blanketed by the Peoria, Wisconsin loss. So now we have an erosion cycle that tops the Sangamon. So this whole sequence that brackets the Loveland loss and the Sangamon is capped and based by erosion cycles. So that's important in understanding the stratigraphic relations. We're going to look at then now, having set that stage, I'm going to look at some data and these three other sites. The most complete site I'm going to talk about is Yaconee River. And we'll put the labeling on this. This is the most complete site because it contains the Farmdale paleosol, which is the soil developed in the late or the early Wisconsin lost to Roxana silt. It blankets the Loveland loss with the Sangamon paleosol in it, and that grades down into a what I'll call here a pre-Sangamon paleosol, and stratigraphically that would place this into what's called the Crawley's Ridge loss. Or in this case, as we'll see, it's not perhaps really Crawley's Ridge, it's still Loveland loss. If we look at, again, the sequence of this, the loss units, Roxana, Loveland, and really what I would think here to be the lower part of the Loveland loss, and the paleosol sequence developed in these. And here we have thermoluminescent ages for those deposits. The Farmdale comes out in this case 52 to 79, the Sangamon 80 to 120, and then the bulk of that unit 91 to 136. So now we have a 100,000 year cycle that's been represents two paleosols in the Loveland and then the Farmdale that's really on an erosion surface cut on to the Sangamon. The next site, the Jeff Davis. Again, these three sites were selected because they have similar morphological and stratigraphic sequences. We have, as you progress farther south in the valley from about Yaukanee River south, you no longer find the Roxana silt. You know, whatever happened to the Roxana silt, I won't answer that today, but I do have an answer for that. Here we have two paleosols developed in the loss unit. The upper one would be the Sangamon, and a question mark on the lower one would, stratigraphically, it's the Crawley's Ridge. All these paleosols are generally 7.5 to 5YR, particularly if they have clay coats on, and they have silty clay loam or argillic horizons. An example, again, from Jeff Davis. Here is the Sangamon paleosol, an intervening BE horizon, which stands out quite clearly, and that grades down to this point, and we'll put the labeling on here so you can see it, to a coastal plain or either a fluvial or marine that has the nice dark red color so it stands out, and two argillic horizons. And then the last site, the Sitaria, again mirrors that, the three loss units and the two paleosols developed in what I think is the Loveland unit with an upper paleosol and a lower paleosol. To look at a little bit of data on this. The Sangamon paleosol in the valley, anywhere we look at it, it varies from about 35% clay to down to about 17. And all these sites generally run silty clay loam in the bulk of the argillic, and that in this case decreases down into the lower part. And then the lower paleosol is never quite as developed as the upper one, mainly for a couple reasons. And if we look at the sand content, and this is important, even though sand is a very minor content, near the contact you always get an increase. And we take this and interpret this as that this is an erosional contact where you're incorporating local sands into that upper part. We can also look at some trends by looking at some fine clay, coarse silt, coarse silt to fine silt, and fine sand to coarse sand, really that being a composite of very fine and fine sand over the coarser sands. Okay, so the higher this number, the more clay, the more fine clay. Notice that the greatest content of fine clay to coarse clay is right at the contact. It's not in the lower part of the argillic. Notice also, in fact, that the upper increment of the pre-existing loss actually has as much fine clay in it as does the argillic itself. In other words, this has been reworked. Now you might think, okay, well these guys missed it in the field. Well, the major contact here has carbonates in it. Peoria loss contains carbonates. There are no carbonates in here. So that's a clean break. What this implies is that you had clay being mixed up into the basal part of the Peoria loss. And if we look at the coarse silt to fine silt, it tends, again, coarse silt on top, fine silt on the bottom, that gives you a positive ratio. The coarser the silt, the higher this number. And as you decrease here into the bottom part of the argillic, what we think is going on is that you're weathering the fine silt out to form clay. And then this last one is fine sand over coarse sand. And even though this is very low, this helps to understand what's going on. Here there's more coarse sand. Here this is primarily the aeolian component that was coming in with the loess. There's not this mixing of local sand being incorporated into the paleosol. And the lower part here, which forms actually the bulk of it, was coming in and has a very uniform distribution of the sand content in it, until you get to the very basal part where you get the mixing from the underlying material. So looking at some of these ratios helps to understand the sedimentation process that goes on here. So it's not only erosion, paleosol development, but the sedimentation processes that brought the loess in that the paleosol sequence was superposed into. We tend to see these similar trends at the other sites. Again, in the E horizon, here, less clay increasing abruptly into the lower BT, the same in the lower paleosol. Again, this truncated thing with the sand content higher in the upper part and lower in the lower part. The silt ratio, again here, increasing with depth. I mean the fine clay ratio, excuse me, increasing with depth. The silt ratio, and then the increasing sand content. So a mirror of what we were looking at earlier. The last site then, for this is the Sitaria site, again, similar relationships, about 30% clay in the paleosol argillic horizon. The fine clay, the coarse clay, again, higher in the upper part, lower in the more lower parts of the argillic. The coarse silt to fine silt ratio decreasing with depth. And here, actually, the sand content coarser in the upper part and increasing, ratio increasing, or fine sand increasing with depth. If we look at some of the mineralogy on these two sites, and this will be the silt grain mineralogy, predominantly these soils and paleosols are dominated by two minerals, quartz and feldspar. So I'm going to look at the quartz to feldspar ratio and the resistant to feldspar ratio. In what you note here is that in the upper part of these soils, that the silt is most weathered. And as you decrease with depth, the weathering ratio decreases. Okay, so the most weathered part of these soils represents the upper part, not the major part of the argillic horizon. And that shows up for both ratios, since they mirror each other. That stays true at our second site at Jeff Davis. And notice also, even in the basal part of the Peoria, the weathering is higher than in the upper part, just a few centimeters above that. So again, incorporation of some of the weathered material upward into the basal part of the Peoria. In the lower part of this paleosol, the upper gone most weathered, and then as you get deeper into it, the weathering ratio drops off. Again, the very basal part of it. So there's a difference to me in these two paleosols. This one represents a shorter time period truncation, and this one represents an accumulation through time with less clay, total clay development, but an accumulating profile upward. So there's a difference between these two soils. Again, we see similar at Sitaria, the same relationships, decreasing resistance with depth. And in the lower one, it's actually reversed. But again, I think this is incorporation upward from the contact with the coastal plain. The key point here is you have to look at the stratigraphic relationships and the sedimentation processes that are going on in these paleosols to understand them. And the last thing I just want to point out, and this is just some X-ray diffractograms from all sites, and these will be K-saturated and heated at 300 degrees. The main thing I'm going to point out here is that every one of these has this broad shoulder on the low angle side of the 7 nanometer peak. This is diagnostic for a mineral which is the interstratified kaolinite schmechtite. Every one of the B horizons that we've ever looked at in these pre-Sangamon paleosols contains this clay mineral. We don't find it in the modern soils, not to any great extent, in the Peorulus or in the Roxana silt. So it's a way to distinguish these paleosols. I'm not quite sure on exactly the genesis and the environmental context of this formation, but it does exist in all these soils at every location we've looked at. So to summarize then, the Sangamon paleosol is a result of pedogenic intensity and duration. I mean, we often hear this thing, was it intensity or duration? And the answer is yes. Less sedimentation, we have to consider less sedimentation in interpreting the paleosol record and the erosion cycles that have gone on separating these different paleosols through time, because not every site is a complete record. They're all different. So we have to look at it on a broad scale and interpret it on a stratigraphic record. So any paleoclimate interpretation should consider the complete context of what we're dealing with. We shouldn't make broad climatic interpretations based on one site. Top or the bottom? There's mixing in it, but it seems to be less than we find in the Sangamon. Sometimes what look like to be very abrupt contacts at the lower part, we find that there's infusions of a bleached silt down into the prism faces of the Sangamon. So there was transformation and translocation of silts from the Farmdale downward into the Sangamon surface.
Would that influence the age you got to the Farmdale?
Personally, yes, I think that does. I think these TL ages are, and I'm not a TL person, so I think they're a good ballpark. You know, if you're going to try to put an age on this, plus or minus 500 years, I'm not comfortable in doing that. I think we don't fully understand some of the mixing processes and how they impact whether it's thermal or optical luminescence dating. I don't think that's well understood. So I think you're right there.
Thank you. I have a question. So in the Sangamon, I'm sort of a little worried now. So you're saying that there was so many erosion cycles. So what sort of information is going to be useful other than there's been a lot of erosion? You're saying that those soils aren't well enough preserved to extract?
No, they're well preserved. The point that I want to make, if we're going into the geologic record and we have one profile, and we go in there, okay, we can understand everything that we need to know about paleoclimatic reconstructions by this one profile. We don't necessarily know the landscape setting that this profile was in. We don't know the other history. I mean, if it's a lust paleosol, the sedimentation record becomes important.
Okay.
So you have to, it's kind of like doing paleoenvironmental reconstructions in the geologic record. You don't look just at one thing.
Right.
You look at, okay, what's the plant community doing? What's the environmental setting? If you're trying to do, human evolution, you try to understand the whole environment that's going on. And I think it's the same for paleosol interpretation.
But it looks like you're suggesting that the Peorian lust was there's a much more stable landscape. In other words, you're suggesting that the Peorian was more stable, or much more stable, in terms of the landscape. The landscape instability seems pretty high during this Sangamon, it seems to me. Relative, I'm just speculating. Do you want to say anything about that?
The Sangamon record and the lust record represents 100,000 years.
Okay.
The Peoria record, the basal part of the Peoria in this part of the world is about 25,000.
Okay, so
we're looking at 25,000 years, but if you go into that basal part of it, you can find an erosion surface that has no carbonates in it. You can find an erosional surface that has carbonates on it that are completely mixing from the Peoria loss. So it's not one simple quick stack with a paleosol development on it.
Right. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Doug.